Thank you very much, and I'm very delighted to be here with a great group of presenters. I'll try to be as brief as I can. I know we run out of time. I see the time here says 5:43, so I have 2 minutes before question and answers. Okay, that's where they came up with the New York Minute. In any event, what I'm going to try to do today, in a brief period of time, I'm going to try to capture the essence of this presentation. And before I do that, I'd like to recognize my doctoral student in the audience, Ming-Der Chen. If you can raise your hand, Ming. He was obviously of great help in helping us review the literature. And also, we have a collaboration with Oregon Health and Science University, Dr. Charles Rum and Janet Peterson, who's in the audience. So we're working together on trying to capture all the data available on physical activity for people with disabilities. So thought I'd mention that. There are no relationships to disclose. And basically what we're trying to do really in the area of physical activity is there are two dimensions of it. One is we're trying to obviously increase access and participation of people with disabilities, and that's not what this presentation is about, but it's very important to look at adherence and access and participation. But really the dimension that we're focusing on in this presentation is health and function and what type of physical activity exposures are necessary to see changes in specific health outcomes. So our first research question was, what is the strength of evidence on 6 major categories of health outcomes? Cardiorespiratory health, musculoskeletal health, functional health, healthy weight and metabolic health, mental health, and we added a dimension of secondary conditions. And the reason why that's in red is because we used 6 of the 9 categories that the Department of Health and Human Services used in a report that they just published this month on physical activity guidelines for Americans. I was fortunate enough to be one of 13 panel members on that committee, which is the reason why we conducted this study, and we were happy to report that they included a chapter on physical activity for people with disabilities, which they didn't do in a 1990 Surgeon General's report. So I have Dr. Peg Giannini to thank for helping me. She's the director of the Office on Disability, for pushing to try to get somebody to represent disability on this panel. So this was kind of an exciting project. The second question we wanted to look at was, what is the incidence of reported adverse events in people with disabilities involved in various exercise exposures? As we know, those of you who work in the field, it's sometimes difficult to get community-based physical activity programs started because many people have reservations about risk associated with participation. So we also defined adverse events within the context of them being serious or not serious. Physical activity guidelines report, that's the front page of it. You have access to it on the internet. It was launched on October 7th by Secretary Leavitt. And this is actually the first set of guidelines ever published for Americans. And so it's kind of exciting that we were at the front end of this. And there is really a good body of evidence in there supporting the use of physical activity for people with and without disabilities, as well as other populations, including pregnant women, and minorities, and a couple of other categories. So the health outcome arena, the areas in this health outcome arena that the HHS used in their report were listed here: all-cause mortality, cardiorespiratory health, musculoskeletal health, metabolic health, energy balance and maintenance of healthy weight, cancer, functional health, and mental health. There isn't any data that we were able to find in the categories of all-cause mortality, metabolic health, and cancer. So there was not one study that we were able to find in these areas pertaining to people with disabilities. The methodology I won't bore you with, but it's very similar to many of the systematic reviews that you'll read in the literature. We used electronic searches, PubMed, Medline in particular, and CINAHL, which is the curriculum index for nursing and allied health literature. We used a variation of keywords, and then when we did retrieve these articles, we went through manually and looked through the reference list and also bore down into the meta-analyses and the systematic reviews that we were able to identify on specific disability groups. And there were 2 abstractors who read each of these studies and then vetted the information that we needed in order to come up with this report. The inclusion criteria was that the study had to be written in English between January 1995 and 2007. Subjects had a physical or cognitive disability, and we identified literature in 11 disability groups. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough information on post-polio and spina bifida and a couple of other categories, so we weren't able to include that information at this time. physical activity, exercise was the primary exposure. That's the other part of this presentation that you need to be aware of. If it was a health promotion intervention that included other dimensions of health promotion, such as nutrition or social support, it was excluded because we were trying to really drill down specifically into what is the effect of a physical activity intervention on health and various types of health outcomes. We used the health outcomes in the HHS report, and these were all peer-reviewed articles. The exclusion criteria were these three things. If it was a specific therapeutic exercise modality, like you'll see a lot of literature on body weight supported treadmill training, using robotics, functional electrical stimulation, gait training, we did not include those studies. We were strictly looking at literature that would have an implication in developing physical activity public health guidelines. And what's so exciting about this conference is I believe the first section, or maybe it's a forum, on physical activity was created and met here this year. So we're hoping that we can work together and work across silos rather than within our silos. And we also eliminated qualitative studies. So this particular graph just gives you a snapshot of the studies broken out by randomized trials, non-randomized, and pre-post studies without a control group. And you can see the different colors are where we found the evidence. And then the criteria for a level of evidence, there are several ways to do this. We used a modification of the U.S. Agency for Healthcare Research and Policy, and type 1 evidence was identified as two or more randomized controlled trials with positive results and no studies reported significant negative effects. Type 2A, one randomized controlled trial with positive results and no studies reported significant negative effects. 2B, at least one non-RCT with positive results and no studies with significant negative effects. Type 3A and type 3B are not bolded there because we found no studies, no prospective observational studies or retrospective studies for that matter on physical activity exposures in people with disabilities. That's quite surprising. And then type 4 was the category of non-significant findings or no studies in a particular disability group. So for today, I just want to focus on these six outcomes: cardiorespiratory fitness, muscle strength, functional health, fatigue and pain, healthy weight, and depression. And these next six slides I'm going to go through very quickly because they essentially have a breakout of the level of evidence by across the y the x-axis disability group, and the y-axis are the number of trials that fit into those three categories that I just described: randomized control trials, non-randomized control, and pre-post studies with no control group. So I'll just go through this first one. You can see a nice overview of where the data are by disability group on cardiorespiratory fitness. This is one that examines the evidence on muscle strength. This third slide, or graph I should say, is on functional health. On fatigue and pain, which we know is a very big issue when we look at different disability groups, you can see the evidence is lacking substantially in this area. Evidence on healthy weight, quite surprisingly, there was no type 1 evidence on weight reduction or maintaining healthy weight in people with disabilities. Type 1, again, is that you know you have to have more than one randomized controlled trial. Evidence on depression, again, lacking on most disability groups. Mental illness, obviously, was one of the major categories on depression. So in terms of the exercise exposure, that's a very common question. Well, what kinds of exercise exposures did these studies include? And they were mixed. You know, some of them used strictly aerobic exercise. Others used a combination of aerobic and strength. And others used even more than that, aerobic strength, flexibility, aerobic dance, and a number of other types of exercise modalities. So, you know, these are also big issues on what works, what doesn't work, and what types of exercise exposures will get you the most bang for the buck. Also, dose is a big thing, and we've heard a lot about dose response and the lack of it when it comes to physical activity intervention. So, interestingly enough, almost all of the studies fell within this category of intensity was 50% of heart rate max or VO2 peak, frequency 3 to 5 days a week, and duration 36 to 60 minutes per session. And I should say that this is strictly for the aerobic training component. The strength component also used standard guidelines that you typically see used on people who do not have disabilities. And I think part of the reason for this is that when we start to get into developing physical activity programs, the issue of liability or getting through an IRB you've got to be able to make the claim that this is safe, and so you go back into guidelines that have been published on people who for the general population. So that's probably the reason. Now, the safety of exercise was quite interesting. In terms of the prevalence of adverse events, as you can see from that bottom part there, less than 2% occurrence of adverse events in the exercise group, which is fairly low, and I'll explain why in the next slide. There were 53 adverse events that we reported from this literature, that were reported in the literature, on over 2,961 subjects. So that's remarkable when you think about, you know, the issues that we commonly hear about really may not be as accurate as we think. And here what we did is we broke out the adverse events by serious and non-serious. So a serious adverse event required the patient, the participant to withdraw from the study, and a non-serious event was the individual was able to complete the study. The participant was able to complete it. As you can see there, 1.15% of the subjects in the exercise group had a serious adverse event, which caused them to withdraw from the study. But again, that's very low. And surprisingly, the control group, who did no exercise, also had adverse events, serious adverse events. So, you know, just not exercising could be as risky as exercising too much. So we broke out the risk of major adverse events, and you could see that, you know, recurrent stroke is something that is an issue. Someone has a stroke, they're exercising at a certain intensity, perhaps that can happen. But as you can see again from this slide, really not much of a difference in people who are sedentary. Control group had a slight increase in recurrent strokes versus the exercise group. But what's really surprising here is in the subjects with multiple sclerosis, there was actually a higher level of exacerbations in people who did not exercise versus people who did. So that might be an interesting question that can be morphed from this particular data set. Cardiovascular problems were usually related to blood pressure. Falls were obviously an issue. And musculoskeletal problems, which you typically would think, you know, pain, soreness as a result of exercise, was the highest level category for adverse events. So in summary, can you believe this? I'm summarizing. I can't believe it. Okay, there is strong. See, Stephen Kay. Take a page out of Stephen Kay. There is strong evidence in certain areas of cardiorespiratory, musculoskeletal strength, and mental health, but only on select outcomes. Because remember, when you look at cardiorespiratory health, there are probably 7 or 8 categories: blood pressure, cholesterol, triglycerides, C-reactive protein, and you can get even deeper into, you know, the thickness of the actual heart wall using echocardiograms. So there's a tremendous bang for the buck using physical activity to improve cardiovascular health. But the only dimension we were able to find was cardiorespiratory fitness, and that only gets you to a certain level of acceptance by an HMO or the medical community to support, you know, providing fitness club memberships or programs to people with disabilities. Second point, more studies are needed on weight reduction, functional health, secondary conditions, cancer, and all-cause mortality. There was almost no data on children with disabilities, almost nothing in the literature on children. Probably the most were on children with cerebral palsy. Exercise can be implemented safely, as we saw. In fact, if you look at the literature on non-disabled, which is also in that report, they have a higher risk of adverse events than this study. Now, I have to mention one caveat, and that is that in all of these interventions, including people with or without disabilities, there's an eligibility criteria. So we might have ended up seeing that people with significant limitations or cardiovascular risk might have been excluded from the data before the intervention began. Research recommendations, and Gloria and I have talked a lot about this on a number of occasions. We clearly need more adequately powered prospective cohort studies. We have no type 3 evidence. So we've got to figure out a way to build a collective team of people nationally who can maintain the fidelity of an intervention, and that their respective institutions or facilities or states begin to help us collect this data on specific disability groups. We need to develop an infrastructure for multi-center clinical exercise trials that, again, reaches outside the university. We've got to work outside the silos because we don't have big enough sample sizes in our respective areas to allow us to develop the kinds of interventions that we're going to see in the literature on people who don't have disabilities. And the third point, examine the dose response effects of very low volumes of exercise in severely deconditioned disabled populations. Again, we weren't able to find anything at a low intensity. 5 minutes a day at 30 to 50% of someone's heart rate max might create tremendous benefits, particularly for people who are at the very, very low end of physical activity. And this is important because many people with disabilities are either concerned about exercising too much and causing injury, or don't want to invest that amount of time. So 5 minutes a day could potentially have, you know, a significant effect on certain key outcomes. Interventions need to drill deeper into key health outcomes, as I mentioned earlier, beyond just fitness. We need a common set of instruments. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of instruments out there to look at fatigue and pain and cardiorespiratory health, and we just need to come up with a common set, not just one instrument, but a set that fits into these categories. Because of inter-individual variability within and between disability groups, classifying participants by function, very similar to David Hollis' presentation using the ICF, rather than disability, may be a viable approach to building the evidence across multiple disability groups. So if we can get ourselves set up on the ICF and figure out what is function, then we might be able to do this across disability groups, which would really work out. I think that'd be very cool and would, you know, again, be generalizable to more of a population base. And I'd like to end with this slide by letting you know that we are, with our through our National Center on Physical Activity and Disability, which was refunded, Mingder and Amy Raworth and others in the room who are working in the center, we're creating an evidence-based, searchable database that hopefully will be available to you in the very near future with the information that we identify. Thank you.
What an excellent panel. Three sessions. It's so interesting what the topics are. Three on educating or translating research findings in medical schools or health professions broadly. One on reducing obesity and another one on increasing physical activity. What do we know about that? So just fascinating, and I'm just thrilled to see where the research is now being translated out and how people are doing that in such a systematic and careful way. Questions from the audience. I know we are really at 6 o'clock. We are exactly at 6 o'clock. I did a bad job as a moderator, only in that I could tell that people were racing to the finish, want a little more explanation of the slides for some of the folks who might have difficulty reading them. So,
as far as exercise for individuals with developmental disabilities, I've seen it with my own 30-year-old son and heard it from others who've worked with individuals over the years as they transition from teenage years into adulthood, into their 30s, that they seem to have a higher challenge with fatigue, less energy, and it doesn't seem to matter that they've been able to exercise or participate in a work environment or social environments. They just seem to almost age faster. And I don't know if you've seen anything like that, but it would be interesting to see if there are any differences now that individuals are living so much longer.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. There's a lot of questions that still have to be answered. There could be potentially the living arrangement changes, so it could be some contextual factor in the environment. They could gain, you know, body composition changes in all of us, so there could be a higher ratio of fat to lean muscle. They could be eating differently, sleeping differently, which could create higher levels of fatigue. So, you know, these are questions that have to, you know, you have to sit down and systematically look at what is, you know, that's an interesting hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Now we've got to figure out, okay, how do we put a research infrastructure on that that's appealing to NIH. What your question is exactly what NIH does with almost every area of science. They just keep drilling down deeper, the R01s keep coming, bing, 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 bing. And we don't get that. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't get that because we don't have that, you know, that process and that procedure. So I'm really speaking to Gloria Crump, mm-hmm. because as a now director of the Office on Disability and Health, but NIH can't, but CDC certainly can.
Oh, I'm just getting challenged today. Other questions?
I'm going to take the opportunity to ask myself one. I just want to add that I didn't have time to share with you that half of our participants are seen in their own homes for their monthly recalls. They schedule with us a date and a time they'd like us to come. And that's in northeast Kansas within a radius of 60 miles of where we're based. And the other half are seen in a two-day clinic in Wichita, Kansas, in a community facility. And instead, they call and make an appointment to a parent or the caregiver brings them into that agency at an appointment time. Just quickly, we're not seeing any difference in weight loss or perseverance in the diet between the two methods of seeing our participants.
You know, what we see in the literature a lot is the adults with intellectual disabilities, females, have a disproportionately higher level of obesity than males. Mm-hmm. And it's really even higher. We know that that's the case also in the population of non-disabled, but do you have any rationale as to why women with intellectual disabilities would be so much higher than men?
Our sample is pretty much 50-50. And the level of physical activity is not terribly different. Yoram?
I think that females typically are a little bit shorter. A lot of them that live in congregate living, we've seen that when they're doling out the food, they give it out equally, and the direct care people or even the parents don't look at the difference in the size of the person and the portion that they're being given.
Yeah, that's certainly true, that the average height of our females is shorter than the average height of our males. That makes the BMI number higher, no matter what the weight is, and gives the physical appearance of more obesity than with taller individuals. Just as a related outcome, we know that those individuals with the shortest stature in our sample are having the hardest time losing the weight at a high rate versus those that are taller and perhaps more physically active. But Muriel's observation is a good one from the first 16 people that we followed from Thursday through Sunday. Everywhere they went and ate and drank and recorded everything except their Friday night out. We let them have their Friday evening out without being observed. They were very nice about the whole process. But yes, what's out there in reality is that caregivers and parents are serving to these individuals exactly the same amount of food, no matter what their current weight situation is. And in most of those environments, we saw that there was certainly the principle of waste not, want not, because anything left in the pan was offered as seconds and thirds. And what we saw in our interviews of staff and now our contact with 100 parents and staff or more is that there's a real lack of awareness of the difference in caloric content across foods. We do a little exercise in which we show that a cheeseburger with a quarter pounder cheeseburger with fries and a regular Coke in terms of calorie content would require you to eat about a bunch of about 15 large carrots to come anywhere close. So in terms of volume, you wouldn't be able to eat 15 carrots. That's very easy to eat a cheeseburger and fries. And so and individuals are just not aware that many of the foods that are eaten and many of the beverages that are drunk are so high in calorie content.
Good. And you tell people are really passionate about their topics. They'll ask themselves questions and then, now Jim is going to do it.
I also think, and I don't think anybody's looked at this, but maybe someone in the audience knows that there may be some hormonal dysregulation in women with intellectual disabilities. You know, there's not a child there, an era there, and you know, estrogen is associated with adipose. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking it might be a combination of hormonal and environment.
It is interesting, then. What I'm struck with is the real-life knowledge that each one of you have brought forward, the kinds of things that really you learned as you're really applying this in very real settings. I'm actually going to call it now and say this has just been very tantalizing. I'm sure everybody is ready for dinner celebrations. There is one more session tonight at 6:30. It's the student and mentor panel. So I think that there are four mentors who have agreed to talk with students and anybody else who is interested in the issue of mentoring, I'm sure. Jana Peterson, if she's still here, has organized that. So thank you all. And thanks for coming.
I just had to say hello to you. I said, oh, I've got to catch up. teacher, though.
Yes, I congratulated you on your new position. I just heard about that.
Yeah.
And I said,
I could want to
get yay! Someone from our team up here.
Thanks. Right.
And it will also come about, like, Thank you. going to ask her opinion about professional mentors in your book.
Yeah. Thank you.
would, I stopped David Holler to say, take an instrument in.
Yes.
I do, yeah. It changed my whole slide thing because of this. Wow. Or the chair.
Maybe you could have laptops in here. And then assistants can use one of your laptops. And then that works well.
Maybe we have to put on the laptop we can come up with.
I want to know if there's any disclosures. They can't file a financial disclosure.
Well,
paid by the special olympics, and they're paying by the special olympics program. Those were the only ones I heard, though. But there are, if you go to health economics section, there's a lot of people who are paid by the drug company to look at the effectiveness of one thing versus another. So I actually had a health economics office mate in graduate school, and she, most of her work was paid for. So, yeah.
Awards ceremony just across the hall.
All right.
River needs to be at this award ceremony. It took it 20 years. Well, it's the 20 years.
But
even though we've only.
I don't think it's a patient.
Well, it's all for the speed.
Okay.
Well, they don't want you to
use that. What time
is
it?
Okay.
It starts at 6:30.
Are under the umbrella of the Association of University Centers. people who are really interested in doing disability health work. That's my little issue.
I'm Kathy O'Connor. I'm currently not a student. I work at Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at the National Center for Health Statistics, and I'm here just because I was interested in the topic and I wanted to listen to what people have to say, because not trying to think is like learning is a continual process. And I'm one of those people that wants to dive in and learn about everything about everything. My undergrad degree is in microbiology, and that experience led me on a long, circuitous route, because at that time the schools of public health weren't as ubiquitous and the programs weren't as ubiquitous as they are now. And I went for a master's degree in public health because I was a clinical microbiologist working in a hospital. And I would see these you know, gonorrhea colds come in, these 15-year-old kids, and I thought, God, there has to be a better way, which made me very interested in prevention. And then that led me into public health. So there I studied a lot of health behavior. I studied statistics and health promotion, disease prevention. And now I work at CDC. I've worked there since 2001. I spent a lot of my life working on the National Survey of Children with Special Health Needs, which National Survey of Children's Health, National Autism Survey, etc. And I would like to go back for a doctorate, but I can't quit my job. I have a mortgage. I have a 7-year-old. I have a husband with MS, and I want to try to learn more. I'm still very interested in school, but I need to identify opportunities. I won't get on my soapbox about that, but.
You know Elizabeth Ralph, is she still there?
She's
at NIH.
I want to say NIH, yeah.
She's still with
you.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm Diana Portino. I'm NPH in Children's Health and Family Health, so the same department that Jan was in at University of Iowa. I'm also doing a Master's in Health Administration, so I'm trying to balance those two interests. Them work together energetically. I'm doing the Lens program at the University of Iowa, which has been really great so far. I'm calling me James Wiskus.
We hear a lot about each other.
We always do, yeah.
Have you met Danica?
So this is our first official I think my interests at this point within disabilities are more on the sort of emotional, behavioral, developmental side. I'm also really interested in health services and sort of how limited English proficiency plays in with disabilities, among other things. So I'm in the process of trying to narrow my
interests. Hi, I'm Eugene Gardner. I'm actually crashing this meeting. I saw the program, well, I saw the description, the listing in the phone book that we get here. So what interested me was the fact that disabilities sponsoring this meeting and that researchers were going to be here. Because I have a profound interest with the deaf community. I'm a hearing person, obviously. I'm not part of the deaf community. I live here in San Diego. I do a distance NPH program from San Jose State. And it's just, I love ASL, American Sign Language. I think it's a beautiful language, and that's what got me interested in the deaf community. However, not too many people, especially professional organizations, are interested in, at least not for my experience in the past 15 or so years. SOPI, Society for Public Health Education, we just had a conference a few days before this started. I submitted 3 abstracts. The only one that didn't get accepted was the one about the deaf community. I was like, what is up with that? And I tracked down the interpreter here because I asked her, are there deaf people here? Because I don't see them. So I guess I'm here to just listen in, absorb. I don't have any, well, maybe I'll come up with specific questions, but I'm very new to this field. I don't know many things, and so what I tend to do is just kick back, listen, and get the groove of things, and then, so we'll see where it leads.
Kelly Chrysler, and I'm a pediatrician, and worked in urgent care, these large children's hospitals, for 6 years. The last 2 years, I've been working on my master's in public health, and I liked the job I had mainly because it allowed me to spend a lot of time with my family. And now my youngest has gone to kindergarten, and now I'm back to work full time. I'm doing a fellowship in developmental behavioral pediatrics. Should finish my MPH in the
translation and transcription, that's gone. And I'm just finding, as someone starting out, that it's hard to get something. So that's a topic I'd like to talk about a little bit.
Hi, my name is Angela Truitt. I go to the University of Illinois Chicago. I'm an MPH student who will be graduating in May. I'm also the section liaison, so if you guys are in the facility section, let me know if there's problems or wonderful things that we're doing here in the lovely disability section. But I'm the liaison from our section to the student assembly, so if there's stuff, I didn't even realize that you're like automatically, if you're a student, signed up for this thing called the student assembly, so and you get a listserv of your own, so if you have questions or comments about that, let me know. I'm also a health educator. I teach HIV and hepatitis education to people with disabilities, primarily people with spinal cord and brain injuries, although I've done some co-education classes for NASL. Where I'm located is very much inner city Chicago, and what you can imagine about that, it's probably all there. So I'm kind of doing health education and health promotion, but with people with disabilities, but not necessarily looking at secondary conditions. So kind of different approach from what a lot of us associate with health care.
Great. Well, now I just hope the four of you can first introduce yourselves briefly and say what your where you work, what you do, kind of your general take on disability.
I'll start. I'm Maureen Crown. I have had a long, circuitous path here. So I kind of found training for a clinical psychologist, went back, went on to get my MPH. Was a youth stand director that had a long-term program at the Master's Mission as well. So I'm involved with the CDC sponsored state and affiliated health programs, as well as Rehabilitation NIDR.
Everybody knows
NIDR. We have the research and training center help along with commercial capabilities. And since the past, in the past month, I've gone to work with the UC. And I'm learning.
Okay, I'm Dave Gray. I have a PhD in genetics at the University of Minnesota. It's a strange degree for what I do. But anyway,
I have a degree in genetics too.
Yeah?
Yeah, in undergrad.
Well, I can learn. I used to be able to do all the statistics for gene frequency. And studied under Sheldon Wiedewald's first book on human genetic counseling. Well, I had some of that experience too. And Herbie Gosman did the twins research heart study. And Paul Mayo, who wrote the book on psychometric testing and whatever. The reason I'm telling you all of this is that those four or five people, Travis Thompson, who wrote 450 articles on development. They were the other ones who broke my neck in 1976. I got my PhD in 1975. So I didn't really have a lengthy career in publishing. I didn't do a postdoc, which is what led to a problem. So it was a little rough there, but those people I just mentioned helped me unbelievably in getting a job, a temporary job at IPA in the Intergovernmental Personnel Act, loan of a person from the state to the government at the so I got to spend a year at the National Institute of Child Health and Development. My job was to review their portfolio on mental retardation as well as disability and my report on it. That was not easy.
So I got involved in cross country and realized So I spent my career working with William McConnell and Frank Ketch, who were the two leaders at that time in exercise science. And sophomore year, I became interested in disability and wanted to know what was available in the exercise physiology literature in this area. And the only thing that was published at that time were studies in Sweden. Who was really the leader of the field was a gentleman by the name of Carl Bostrom from Sweden, who wrote the first book on physiology, textbook on work physiology. So the way I got into it is I was always interested in physical activity and wanted to know if there was a dimension that I could contribute to that wasn't currently being done. And that was the area of disability. It was just nothing out of that field. So I went on to Ohio State and studied with